President Obama took to the airwaves last night to address the nation concerning the response to the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Some are calling it a political response to an environmental problem, but the politics of the situation are palpable and undeniable. This is Politics Dan Talk of Iowa. I'm Jonathan Aull. Also on today's show, we'll talk about a comment made by Iowa Congressman Steve King that has led to pushback from conservatives and Tea Party members. And misspent money by Governor Culver while he was Secretary of State is the latest development in the Iowa gubernatorial race. We'll talk about those issues with New Hampshire-based political analyst Arnie Arneson and political science professors Dennis Goldford of Drake University and Bruce Gronbeck of the University of Iowa. Plus your phone calls and emails. Politics Day on Talk of Iowa, coming up after this check of news from NPR and Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. It's Politics Day. President Obama talks tough about the Gulf. Steve King says some things that have gotten him in trouble with his own constituencies. And Governor Culver may be facing some heat from what he did while he was Secretary of State. Joining us today on the program is New Hampshire-based political analyst Arnie Arneson. Good morning, Arnie.
Good morning. How are you?
And here in the studio in Des Moines is Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University. Thanks for joining us, Dennis.
It's a pleasure.
And out in our Iowa City studios is Bruce Gronbeck, professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning.
So, Arnie, before we get too far, you're only going to be with us for the first half of the show, but Iowa Public Radio listeners will be able to hear a lot more from you later today.
Yeah, actually, Talk of the Nation is coming to New Hampshire. I wonder why. And I'm going to be doing the national segment of their show with Ken Rudin and Neil Conan at about 2:40 Eastern time. So you'll hear me on Talk of Iowa, and then I get to segue to Talk of the Nation. Any messages?
That'll be one. Well, it'll be 1:40 here in Iowa when you're going to be on. So, if you have questions for our panel, 866-780-9100, or email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And also, if you have something you want Arnie to speak up about while she's on Talk of the Nation, you can send that our way as well. Let's start with President Obama. Last night, he did an address to the nation from the Oval Office talking about the government response to the BP oil spill. How well did he do? We'll start with you, Arnie.
Well, someone just sent me an email, so let me just share a little bit of that email. And this is they started out with a quote from Paul Begala. Obama entered the Oval Office on the run from critics, blasting his response to the BP oil spill. He left having once again shown why his calm, cool approach connects with the country, Paul Begala. And my friend wrote, "Seriously, man, don't do this kind of brown-nosing political hack stuff. Not only is it beneath you, but Americans are so not buying it. The last thing we need of you, Paul, of all people, is heck of a job, Barry, analysis of such a heartbreakingly disappointing performance." I'm not sure I'm as harsh, but there were a couple of things. And you actually heard it if you were listening to public radio yesterday, because right after the president spoke, they went to Louisiana. And shock of shocks, members of the constituency in Louisiana are furious with the president, not only because of his response, but because of his moratorium on drilling. Because if you know anything about Louisiana, it isn't all Cajun cooking, and it isn't all New Orleans. It turns out that the oil and gas industry produces most of the revenue and most of the jobs down there. You know, as someone said, the Gulf has been besmirched for years and years and years, and just now we're noticing. And the fact is that they're horrified at the thought of a moratorium. And I think what's heartbreaking is that President Obama did not anticipate that reaction and include that in his speech, because this is about tough times. Louisiana is being buffeted from every which way, and the fear of losing that great, high-paying oil job is terrifying. But he needed to address that, too, because that's part of the challenge. It isn't just the cleanup. It isn't just protecting the environment. It's about how people are going to segue from that line of work to whatever the next line of work is, and how are they going to be helped.
Bruce, what's your take on Obama's performance last night?
Well, I thought he tried, to give a war speech. It kind of reminiscent of one that Nixon tried in 1971 in his call for energy and independence, and Jimmy Carter with the moral equivalent of war kind of analysis in 77. Presidents trying to turn energy questions in general into something that can capture the general public's enthusiasm and imagination. And I think he still is struggling with that because, again and again, of course, the question comes down to the timing. So how come you're so late? And I need help today, not tomorrow or the next day. If radio went to the drilling question, CNN went back to fishing. Both of those kind of industries along the Gulf, of course, are feeling the pinch, and at a scale that makes even an escrow fund by BP seem awfully small in response to the problem. So the urgency of the immediate situation, with presidents trying desperately to get a public to see a larger picture, I think gives us a clash of needs and interests that will just keep this thing roiling.
Dennis, the president obviously was trying to talk directly to the American people, and it sounded, at least to me, like he was trying to fall back on what got him elected, that kind of speech pattern, that kind of discussion thing. What's your interpretation of how the electorate will interpret what he said last night?
I kept thinking of somebody who goes to the hospital with a broken leg, and the doctor says, well, let's talk about putting you on a good exercise regimen and learning how to eat right. And the person at the hospital says, fix my leg. And so the segue or the shift to talking about energy policy broadly, maybe over the long run, there are arguments for his particular view, there are arguments against his particular view. But in terms of the practical kinds of things that Arnie talked about with regard to jobs in the Gulf and things like that, that's what people want to know. Clean this up and let's take care of dealing with the economic impact.
Now, if he one of the things that he said was demanding BP pony up some money into an escrow fund that would be managed by a third party to handle all of the claims and the payment issues, did that get lost? And if that happens, is that the big victory for the Obama administration?
Well, you know, BP has been saying all along they will pay certainly if the full cost of any legitimate claim, and that's always the kicker, what counts as legitimate in their view. But as you know, even if we have an accident of some sort and our insurance covers it, it never compensates you for the time and aggravation and worry and stress that you've gone through.
And it's worse than that.
Yeah.
It's about the past. It's about the past. It is not about how you cope with the present. It's not about how your future is going to change. I mean, that's part of the problem. And again, the whole idea of legitimate, you know, they're going to legitimately compensate you. I think Barack Obama should have used that word and said the determination of legitimacy is not going to be BP. They're going to put this money into an escrow account. It's going to be done by an independent advisor, and we will determine legitimacy, not BP, because their definition and what may be real may be very different.
Well, and it was interesting, too, that right after the speech, BP played an ad, at least the one, as I say, flipped over to CNN, and they played an ad talking about the $70 million they've spent and the people they've got in the ground who are from Louisiana and love the area and love the world of Louisiana and the coast and are going to do everything they can. They're busy trying to counter that move. And in one sense, I think this is a calculated risk for the Obama administration. If they become in charge of everything, then they too will deserve all of the blame, and BP will be off the hook. We throw money at the problem, and now you fix it.
Well, to what extent is this a no-win situation for the administration? Because even if they're excellent at this, there are still going to be problems. Even if there is a great response, it's going to take months to deal with the first layer of this issue and years, decades to deal with the additional layers of this issue.
You know what, Jonathan? He should have said that last night. He did not take any of the responsibility for a tepid response, for what happened with the Mineral Management Service, with what happened with the ability to regulate, and that the regulators were playing cozy with the industry, and that's part of the problem. I mean, part of his opportunity wasn't just to talk about the big picture, about changing our whole, you know, energy relationship, but it was an opportunity for him to say, you know what, a lot of people are going to be unhappy here. we've made a lot of mistakes, and the question is, if we don't acknowledge these mistakes, we'll make them again. So we better acknowledge them now, because we have to figure out how to fix it. And there was no idea that government made a mistake, too. You know, you can blame BP all you want, but in the end, even if BP disappears, your government's going to be sticking around for a long time. And if things don't get better, you're going to blame them. So here was an opportunity to act like a real adult and acknowledge not only mistakes, how difficult it will be, and that you're going to a lot of people are going to be unhappy here for quite a long time. But you know what? We're going to have to deal with it. And I just, there wasn't that force. And I think, again, his cool response is problematic, because it also offers sort of a cool answer in it'll be okay. You know what? It ain't going to be okay.
But Americans, you could say, unfortunately perhaps, keep looking for an Oprah moment in our politicians, particularly in the president. Now, you could make the argument that that's completely inappropriate for the president, but the presidency has become an Oprah institution. And they want the president to show that he's interested and concerned and passionate. And, of course, you could make the argument, no, his job is to help assist fixing the problem or marshal the forces, private sector and public sector, to fix the problem, and don't worry about the Oprah aspect of it. But that's the hand presidents seem to have to play now.
Well, should before we go to break, let's address the issue. Should he have addressed the nation last night? Because clearly, even before anybody heard what the president had to say, there were discussions of the history of addresses from the Oval Office. There was, you know, this was his first one from the Oval Office. Should he have done it? And was he playing to that Oprah moment?
I think he did it for political reasons. I mean, I haven't felt, perhaps I've been missing it, but here in Iowa, I haven't felt any direct impact on me in my daily life of this problem, even though it's horrendous to watch on TV and I can't bear to look at the pelicans and the animals and things like that and the beaches for the people. But in a sense, it's a regional catastrophic problem. But I think he addressed the nation less for that particular issue than for his particular political fortunes.
Bruce, what's your take on
that? I agree that to pick this for his first Oval Office address, equivalent to the maiden speech kind of thing almost in politics in general, was a signal that it's important enough to try and hook the entire country together in and around this problem, even though it's regional. And of course, finishing then with once again the call for revolutions, even in the American energy equations that run the country. The problem, of course, goes back, as I said earlier, to the fact that there are such seemingly pressing immediate issues, right? Pelicans and shrimpers and the need of suddenly billions of dollars apparently going to be lost if folks can't drill right now.
But animals matter, Bruce. Animals are your best selling technique. Someday ask people who raise money. What raises more money, like puppies with mournful eyes or little children? And they'll tell you they've made more money on the puppies.
Baby seals and cormorants in the first Gulf War. True.
Exactly. So in some ways, he also was looking at the polls, Jonathan, because the polls were saying the American people were now ready to listen to a change of energy conversation. So he was also playing to what the polls were indicating.
I think very much.
We'll get to that in just a moment. Bruce Gronbeck, Dennis Goldford, and Arnie Arneson, Politics Day on Talk of Iowa. Back in a minute here on Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. It's Politics Day. Our guests are Dennis Goldford from Drake University, Bruce Gronbeck from the University of Iowa, and New Hampshire-based political analyst Arnie Arneson. Also taking your phone calls and emails, 866-780-9100, or email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're talking about the president's address last night to the nation regarding the BP oil spill and the Gulf of Mexico. So I'm curious, we talked about it real briefly, but this whole notion of this third party running an escrow fund. Earlier this week on NPR, White House spokesman Robert Gibbs said unequivocally the president had the power to force BP to pony up the money without some kind of federal lawsuit. Now, maybe I didn't pay attention well in class. And we have some teachers here. Did I miss something? Does he have that power?
I'm not sure. You know, I teach constitutional law as one of my my functions at Drake. And I thought, well, the president has certain kinds of emergency powers, certain prerogatives. But I just wasn't sure about that particular claim by Gibbs.
Right. And I certainly didn't hear the legal basis for making that claim. So I too was surprised. But, you know, you teach con law. I teach political communication and media stuff. So, yeah, that's not certainly
and
my
I
center.
And I teach lawsuits. And well, that, honey, is ripe for a lawsuit. And trust me, every single oil company who basically said, oh, we would never have done what BP did. Oh, absolutely never would have done that kind of stuff, is also looking at what Barack Obama is trying to do. And it won't be just BP that will be suing Barack Obama and the United States. It will be all the oil and gas companies because they don't want that authority taken away from them. I'm telling you right now, it's not just BP that will be worried by what the president is suggesting he can do.
But does BP have any incentive to go along with this? Because if they do fork over $40 billion, which I think is like a half of a quarter profit for them, if they do put that kind of money in it and agree to this, do then they get to kind of wipe their hands a little bit and say, look, we did everything the government asked us to do?
I think that's their negotiating point, right? That what they've got the possibility of here is capping their obligation. And I think that's dangerous. That's dangerous to cap that obligation at even $20 billion, more than I make in a month, to be sure. But yet, when you think of the long-term effects of all this, that may be a real bargain for them.
And here's the rock and the hard place for the administration, because on the one hand, you'll have all sorts of people saying to the administration, and particularly the president, fix this problem. On the other hand, you have all sorts of people, certainly among the Republicans in Congress, but also out in the country, saying, oh, but you have very little or should have very little or no power to regulate or compel private industry to do certain things. Mm-hmm. So fix the problem, but there's very little you can do to make anybody do that.
Are they interested in a cap on the money or the cap of the responsibility or both?
Both.
Both. Well, I think BP still will be subject. I mean, right now we were beating the drum last week, right, for criminal proceedings. That is not going to go away. Although if they can negotiate a cap on their economic responsibility, as I say, I think that's a great deal for them, and they ought to be happy to pick that up.
Let's go to the phones. Bill from Brazil is on the line. Bill?
For all the other questions of what power the executive office has, it seems to me that the leases are one place that the executive has complete control over, and the threat of removing those from BP could be frightening enough for them to go along with what is suggested.
Wow. Is that equivalent to a shakedown or extortion if you say, well, if
no,
you don't
no.
put...
No, I mean, with all of the violations they have already, they could have put the kibosh on some of the stuff they're doing. But that is something that the government has control over, it seems to me, at any point, but especially when you've had violations right and left.
Bill, right. Do you think, Bill, just as long as we have you on the line, do you think the president is doing enough? Are you happy with the administration's performance?
No, the more I see the, you know, especially the stuff I was less aware of today, that basically, they're keeping out reporters. They're in leaving BP in control of everything, and especially for the cleanup. I agree. That's absolutely that's something that we should be responsible for, just as we should be responsible back with Katrina. And then you charge it up to BP's account.
But
Bill, thank you very much for your call. Yeah, go ahead, Arnie.
On the cleanup issue, the problem is, remember, we started out at 1,000 barrels a day or 1,000 gallons a day, and we're up to now 60,000. And I mean, you can't even keep on top of cleanup because cleanup, the magnitude of cleanup keeps changing. And I think that is where it becomes so frightening because every time you turn around, the estimate is going, it's exponential, the growth. And yes, we need to deal with the cleanup, but we have never, I mean, Katrina was quantifiable. Katrina stopped. The hurricane stopped. You knew how bad it was. You just were slow to respond. This just doesn't stop. You know, this is not a spill. This is a gusher.
So what's next for the Obama administration? Is there a winning strategy here that they can take on that will both address the practical issues of the oil issue and also curry popular opinion to be behind the president?
I think they seem to be working as you watch the sequence of moves with a strategy that's been developing over the last week and a half or so. They certainly floated the idea a couple weeks ago about using leases as leverage. Though you know this is also an administration that wants to increase offshore drilling, so that they got to have a lot of support from other companies. But now to go after control of the economy of the whole cleanup is the center of the strategy now. With again late last week those first suggestions of criminal proceedings. Waxman yesterday talking about the conversations of. And material available through email on people simply glazing over problems that were developing technologically and moving forward without safety controls. I mean, we're getting set up for a huge multi-stage sort of assault. But again, no matter how rational and clever that looks, that still doesn't help. With the immediate problems of the Gulf. And that refrain, you know, just pounds on us in 24/7 news.
I may make one last comment. You asked what the winning strategy is. We have all lost. And that's what Barack Obama needs to say. We have all lost. There is no winning here. That's the wrong frame. That's even the wrong question. We have lost. And then the question becomes, how do you deal with this loss, and how do you make it smaller, make it less significant? But we've all lost. There is no question here.
But Arnie, if you're a Democrat in a competitive district in November, can you tolerate the president, even if it's the right thing to do, morally, ethically, best for the nation? Can you tolerate politically listening to your president say, "We messed up. We're in trouble. This is a bad scene"?
Let me leave you with one thought, and that's this. And I sent it to Bruce this morning. My response to what happened last night was not only what I have said: we have all lost, and recognize that there are going to be losers in Louisiana because we are going to have to change our energy patterns. But then I would have turned to New York, and I would have turned to the New York delegation that is now trying to gut the financial regulations and trying to basically protect Wall Street at all costs, and say, you know what, you're going to have to lose too. You know, if we're going to ask people on the Gulf Coast to change behavior, then we're going to have to change behavior with our relationship with protecting banks and protecting Wall Street, and you're going to have to lose too. I think what you do is you then cover your Democrats because you've acted like an adult. You reminded people that everybody's going to protect their own particular butt, but in the end, we are responsible for protecting the country.
Dennis Goldford, do you believe a Paul Tsongas like "eat your spinach" Stop. Message is going to fly?
You keep accusing me of that, Jonathan.
Well, Arnie, I'm just recalling Walter Mondale in his acceptance speech in 1984, saying, "I'm going to raise your taxes, and so will President Reagan. I told you he won't." That didn't work for Mondale very well.
I know, and you know what? I guess there's an innocence on my part because I keep thinking at some point in time treating people like an adult will make a difference. But you're absolutely right. We want a fairy tale. It's what always happens. We want to socialize pain, and we want to be capitalist when it comes to greed. You know, and we're all like that. And that's one of the reasons why it is so difficult to turn around the ship of state when it needs to turn.
Arnie, thank you so much for being with us. And do well on Talk of the
Thanks.
Nation today.
Thanks,
we know
Arnie.
You'll make us proud.
Okay, ciao. Bye-bye, you guys.
When we come back from the break, Bruce Gronbeck will stay with us. We'll talk about Representative King and his comments that are getting him into some trouble and the scandal revolving around Chet Culver when he was Secretary of State. Coming up on Talk of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Joining us for the remainder of the show, Dennis Goldford from Drake University, Bruce Gronbeck, who teaches communications specializing in political media at University of Iowa, and also your phone calls and emails, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, 866-780-9100. Let's talk about 5th District Congressman Steve King in the western part of Iowa. Earlier this week, he told G. Gordon Liddy on Liddy's radio show that President Obama, quote, has a default mechanism in him that breaks down the side of race on the side that favors the black person. That conversation, those comments have gotten him into some hot water, including with some people who would normally philosophically agree with him. He was to speak at a fundraiser for a GOP candidate in Colorado, and that was canceled. And also he was taken off of the bill of a Tea Party event in Colorado as well. So Dennis and Bruce, did Steve King step in it to a point where there's going to be severe political ramifications?
I don't think so. Steve King always pushes the envelope. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. But the 5th District is one of the most Republican districts in the country, and it's always an uphill, really almost vertical battle for a Democrat out there who attempts to unseat him. So there might be some short-term feelings that he's a little touch radioactive right now, particularly given some of the issues with the Tea Party and other Republican campaigns. But I don't think there's any – given his constituency, I don't think there's any long-term issue. Bruce may think differently.
Well, sooner or later, he's getting challenged by somebody strong enough to at least give him a run. And Matt Campbell may be the person to do that. I thought his response was pretty good. Let's focus on the real issues that are affecting Western Iowa, and these are all distracting, and we can't go through life that. And sooner or later, he's going to point out, I suspect, that Steve King has become one of the darlings of Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, who hunts down Steve King regularly, though I agree that I'm not sure how many people in Western Iowa probably watch The Daily Show. But he's certainly getting his share of flack. I've visited his office once, and it was pretty clear when I was talking to some of his staffers that they know that the kind of press he gets, or at least they think this is so, is helpful to him. That Western Iowa is getting somebody is getting national recognition and for their part of the country. So I think it's going to be a fascinating campaign if folks go in on the Democratic side to help Matt Campbell do a strong run. He certainly ought to do better than the other people who've just been mowed down by King since 2002.
We have an email in from James in Dubuque who writes, "It never ceases to amaze me the comments coming out of the leadership in Western Iowa." James is asking his constituents, does this represent your views? So James from Dubuque would like to hear from people who live in the 5th District. You can call us at 866-780-9100 or talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. Let me reframe the question this way. Both of the pushbacks on this were from Colorado. The Tea Party event that he was going to be at Colorado and a fundraiser he was going to be at. Obviously, that's less significant than if it happened in his own district. However, as someone who lives in the district, is there any concern about his ability to get things done on a national platform if he's seen as a lightning rod?
Well, that's, of course, what Matt Campbell's trying to argue, right, is that he will really have no influence to speak of on party work and on legislation if he spends his time making these kinds of pitches. Whether Campbell can make that stick by pointing to specific legislative actions, I don't know. I'm just saying it's not a bad strategy politically to be doing what he's doing.
You've got to remember, in terms of the structure of the House of Representatives, unlike the Senate, where a minority of the vote of the members or even one senator can have a big impact and really play a significant role in what goes on, in the House, if you are the minority, really you don't have any power at all. About the only thing you can do is what Representative King does quite often, which is show up on special orders on C-SPAN, and you see him delivering various sorts of remarks. So in a sense, Campbell could argue that as long as there's a Democratic majority in the House, he as a Democrat could do a lot more for the district than Steve King as a member of the minority party can. King, of course, would argue that if you change that and Republicans take the House, he's in a position to do a lot for the district.
Let's go to the phones. Larry from Webster City is on the line. Larry, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I guess my comment is that between Steve King and Michelle Bachmann from Minnesota, I'm not sure what district they actually represent. My suspicion is it's Mars or something like that. My comment was primarily that, you know, earlier we were talking about we don't want mature adults in office because we keep voting the children back in. At least that's the gist I took from it. And I think that's the problem. If we were actually mature adults and were responded to thoughtful discussion of the issues, I think people like Steve King and Michelle Bachmann and some of the other folks that seem to delight in rabble-rousing wouldn't even be up for office, much less in office. And I'll take your response off the air.
Well, Larry, before you go, Webster City, he left. Webster City's in the 4th District. I was going to ask him about his perception of Congressman Latham. Well, Bruce and Dennis, you heard what Larry had to say. What's your take on that?
Well, of course, one of my first reaction is that Michelle Bachmann makes him look pretty good. But it's interesting that we're getting that you're having this kind of odd border culture that is affecting all. And I don't know what to make of that exactly. But except to say that given this, I'm a native of northern Minnesota, a very different kind of world than she runs, but. I agree that these people are sitting out there as hit men and women doing a lot of what I think some parts certainly of the GOP think has to be done, that they need some people wielding the whip and then some of the others can come in a more centrist sort of way and see if they can capture the center of the vote. It's an odd strategy, but I think that the Republicans, maybe because of the splits between the social and economic conservatives or the value voters and the intellectual conservatives have maybe no other choice.
There's a real constituency out there that's been around for a long time, and it's comprised of people who believe, and you could argue accurately or inaccurately, that they have lost or are in danger of losing the America they grew up with. Remember the woman interviewed during one of the Tea Parties spring of 2009 when she said, feeling quite threatened, quite angry and emotional, "I want my country back." And Steve King, like Michelle Bachmann and others and various people in conservative talk radio, speak for that constituency. Again, you can argue they're wrong, you can argue they're right, but they're there.
Well, but that whole "I want my country back," obviously people who philosophically agree with the people who said that, they feel impassioned about it, that it's a return to a value system and some core beliefs in the Constitution. People who don't agree with them say that that's some kind of code for nefarious behavior and values that people don't want to own up to. So I'm wondering, when Steve King actually comes out and says the president favors the black person, is he at some level cutting through, at least some people will say he's cutting through the code that people were talking about when they said those kinds of statements?
Well, that certainly itself is not code. That's pretty blunt.
Well, exactly.
But I wouldn't say that. Certainly, it'd be wrong to say that all opposition to President Obama and the Obama administration is based on racism or anything
when,
like that.
But when Steve King says that, does even if it's completely incorrect, mm-hmm. does it pour gasoline on the fire of the people who believe that?
Oh, it's certainly incendiary. There's no question about that. But is it any more incendiary than Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, Sean Hannity, Michelle Bachmann? No.
Well, and the other thing it seems to me is that I agree that race questions have been coded, it seems to me, pretty heavily for the last quarter century, though mostly around the issue of crime, right? And talking about city crime, you really are dealing in many ways with race issues. What's beginning to happen, maybe it's in part because of the immigration bill debates, the Muslim charge that Obama faced during the election and any number of other things, is that comments that you would have expected to have been coded in some way are now beginning to float free and open. And it seems to me that that's a different kind of thing. And it's not as though it hasn't happened historically in this country. It has, of course, several times throughout the 20th century after World War I and in and around the period of World War II. We had similar kinds of ethnic and race questions floating very freely in the public sphere in this country. The fact that they're coming back now in open source of ways, I think, gives us one of the clues that the country in many ways feels itself in certain serious kinds of trouble. That wonderful book, What's the Matter with Kansas, was tapping into, and we got to in some way confront this pretty directly.
Well, the Kansas book was an interesting book, but it was disputed by a lot of folks. But one thing to bear in mind is if you look at the 2008 election results, 65.3% of John McCain's electoral vote came from the South. And
right.
the Republican constituency nowadays and the conservative constituency tends to be fall along these particular factors, most of which, except for one, affects certainly the 5th District of Iowa, rural, white, male, older, and Southern. And, of course, we're not Southern. But all those other factors, that's really become the core Republican constituency, which is a declining demographic. And that's what makes a lot of people there feel they're losing their country. And people, again, like Steve King, I can remember when he was in the State House talking about English as the official language 10 or 15 years ago.
Right.
But King, Bachman, as well as conservative talk radio speak for that constituency.
Bruce, you're the communications you're right. expert. Does this give Steve King even more evidence that he can say whatever he wants and he doesn't have to worry about there being significant backlash in his district?
Well, he's been able to do that, right, throughout his entire tenure. I think he probably sees, and maybe it is, his constituency in ways that, you know, it was just described. The only thing we know is that more women than men vote. That may save the centrist part of the electorate. Although I don't think so. He's got a license to keep going as long as he doesn't have to pay any political consequences.
There was, though, I think at least a little embarrassment by the fact that he was shown the door by Republicans, people you would think would be his normal constituency, even if it was in Colorado. I think that Stu Rothenberg, very noted political handicapper, called South Carolina the stinkhole
right.
of Republican politics. I know that the 5th District of Iowa certainly is not that and does not want to be thought that. So I think there are some limits about what King could do.
Yeah, well, we are nowhere near that, the South Carolina. And three cheers for Nikki Haley's victory here last week.
Let's move on to one more topic before the end of the show. An audit report continues to show that while Chet Culver was Secretary of State, there were some allegations of misspending money from the Help America Vote Act that came to light, that a lot of it was spent on a consultant, that it may have been spent on education and some other issues that were inappropriate. Opponents of the now Governor Culver have said that for a long time now that he tried to use that money to help get himself elected as governor. Governor Culver's response was that the first round of allegations of misspent were up around $2 million. They went and they did more paperwork and they showed that it was legitimate. Now the number keeps going down. And he says when everything's all said and done, he'll be completely exonerated. November is a long way away, but do Dennis and Bruce, do you guys think that this issue has any legs, and is this going to be one of the things that we hear about from the Branstad campaign?
Well, I think it'll keep going, of course, until it's resolved, because it'll always be there. And of the remaining half million or so, 444,000 of it, or 85-90% of it, was money that was paid to his Secretary of State's office, to the State Public Policy Group, for staff and support. And unless he can document that money, I gather, at least this is, seems to be the case, as directly moving into the Help America Vote Act guidelines. And I'd be the first to admit that that act was passed very quickly without an awful lot of attention to the implementation details, unless he can show that the money just didn't go to support his office, then that may stick around a while. The rest of it, I think, you know, I agree that he probably can say we were doing, you know, public ads and events to help to get out the vote in general and to register more people as the act tries to call for. But that'll be a sticking part of it, I think.
This is still a developing story, and I can't say that I'm familiar with most of the details of it. But I would say more broadly that Governor Culver reminds me of a guy who's going to engage in a coin flip. And the person with the coin has a coin that's heads on both sides. And Governor Culver would call heads, and it would come up tails. I mean, he just can't win for losing. And it's not that there's one particular issue, absent some horrific scandal or anything like that, but if in the public mind things like this pop up that seem to confirm a pattern, that's what's really dangerous politically. Not one particular incident, but if any particular incident people start to associate as something that fits into a broader pattern, that's really deadly in a political and electoral sense.
Does it matter even on the accuracy of it? Because my little synopsis of this was incredibly brief, but that's more than a lot of people will ever understand about the details of the audit. But if they see headlines or if they see political ads that splash up that he was implicated in some kind of scandal and they don't take the time to learn all the details of it, does the validity of the allegation even matter? And does it damage Governor Culver's chances in November, regardless of what happens next as the story develops?
Certainly doesn't help. And people do live in a kind of headlines world at best. Otherwise, Bruce and I'd be out of a job because, you know, our job is always to say we got to look behind and beneath and inside the headlines. But yeah, any kind of adverse publicity, and that's the point about the danger of a pattern forming.
Well, and of course he's vulnerable, right? He's after his first term. You're in the by-election after a presidential election, where the party in power is expected to lose seats and even governorships. And until he's able to actually say, here's what we've accomplished as a party in power for the state of Iowa. And not just by going and reading a book to a few 4-year-olds, but being able to build stand on parts of his record very explicitly, he's in trouble. You're right. He's going to just get nibbled to death.
Well, and with all of these other issues that are going on, does the gubernatorial race in the fall just really come down to what the condition of the economy is like in September and October?
An awful lot. Yeah, go ahead.
A great deal. I think the fact that the Branstad campaign wants to focus on the economy and jobs as opposed to social issues the way the Vanderplatz people wanted him to do and the Iowa Family Policy Center still wants him to do, that indicates that it really is about the economy and jobs. And we have to remember at the same time that every election where there's an incumbent running is essentially a referendum on the incumbent.
I agree, and I think it, frankly, is much, much smarter for the GOP side to be working on the economic issues and the social issues. The social issues haven't been able really to sweep a party in or out in this state, and for me, that's great.
But what about the concept of energizing the base? Because we hear that all the time, and Dennis, this might be a good one for you, specializing in electoral issues. Is there a real factor of energizing the base, and does Branstad at least need to do some work on saying the things about same-sex marriage or about abortion or about any of these other social issues that the base needs to hear to get excited, to volunteer, to make a phone call, to have a yard sign?
He just wanted to get out of jail free card because Steve Scheffler just endorsed him from the Iowa Christian Alliance. And so that certainly helps. I think he wants to hold on to those folks, but the key that makes him competitive with Governor Culver, if you look at the polls, is that he just creams the governor among independents. And the more you talk about those more divisive issues, the more you endanger your support among independents. So if he can sort of keep those tamped down and then talk about jobs and the economy, he can try to pick up independents who this time around in Iowa and nationwide have moved back towards Republicans.
And he can make a series of moves. He did, you know, late last week said that he's not going to pick a lieutenant governor who supports same-sex marriage. So he can sneak them in, but I think he's doing so far, although it's a very young campaign, of staying on message.
Well, do we think that platform – are there enough independents to swing this? Because the Democrats have a registration advantage in the state of Iowa.
Oh, but 37% of registered voters in Iowa are independents. Right. 34% are Democrats, 29% are Republicans.
So there's plenty of room for the independents.
You can't win without the independents in the state of Iowa statewide.
Right. I mean, I always go back to the presidential elections of 2000 and 2004 where you know, a Democrat wins by 4,000 votes in 2000 and then a Republican comes in to win by 7. We just swung 11,000 votes and changed the party's color. I think this is a wonderful swing state that group of independents who are not simply independent but generally politically active, which I think is refreshing in a lot of ways, and it's one of the things that you know that keeps our voting rate higher than most states in the country and a lot of other things. It's great.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for Talk of Iowa today. I want to thank my guest, Arnie Arneson, who left at the midpoint. She'll be on Talk of the Nation, 1:40 local time, so make sure to join us on Iowa Public Radio. Listen for Arnie Arneson on Talk of the Nation. Also want to thank Dennis Goldford from Drake University and Bruce Gronbeck from the University of Iowa. Gentlemen, thanks for being on the program.
A pleasure.
A pleasure, indeed.
Our program is produced by Dennis Reese. Assistance today from Jeff Schmidt, Christina Sarnelli, and John Pemble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa is available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can email us anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks to Julie Englander for technical support. I'm Jonathan Aull.